Welcome to Movie Crush, a production of iHeartRadio. Kanda. Estrada, Mantos, Idrex, Nocturum, Nosferatu, Kanda, Amantos, Kanda.
Hello.
This is the laugh, the last part of that bit.
Yeah. Hello, it's me. You've just summoned your guest.
Hey, everybody. Welcome to Movie Crush. That was Joe Garden's great idea to start off this great, great Evil Dead 2 tribute with the words from the Book of the Dead.
Yes, the Book of the Dead, legend has it.
How you doing, man?
I'm doing okay. It's been, we ran into each other at the cafe nearby and I
know, so funny. I ordered a sandwich, I turned around and you were just lurking there like a slasher.
Hello, Charles.
Of all the places, I guess it was the closest sandwich place to the New York studio, which is where we are.
Yeah, there's a Starbucks downstairs, but you know, why go for Starbucks when you can support a little independent, a little big independent bakery?
That's right, the Grand Daisy Bakery.
Yes.
Had a delicious sandwich.
I had a delicious a pain au chocolat. That's a chocolate croissant for those of you that don't speak French.
So I know what you're, how you're doing because we caught up and talked a little bit of slasher movie stuff in the bakery.
Yeah.
And I told you I've been kind of catching up on some of these things I'd never seen before.
Which is super fun. Yeah. It's nice to go and it's still amazing how many horror movies there are out there that you need to catch up on.
Like, yeah, you hadn't seen The Burning, and I was shocked.
I hadn't seen The Burning.
Yeah.
And this is the first year I've seen Halloween 3, Season of the Witch, which is the one without...
yeah, I've heard that's really good.
It is bad and good. It
okay.
is like, it is like, it's, well, it's interesting because like the, there's a romance between a 48-year-old and a 22-year-old that's really kind of gross.
But it's like every other movie.
Yeah. But the 22-year-old, in this case, happened to be the inspiration for Manhattan. The actress dated Woody Allen when she was 17. And I know Manhattan was your favorite movie at one point.
It was for a while.
And now a little bit, and it's even a little bit more problematic now that you know that.
Yeah.
And he maintains, oh, we never had a relation. And she was like, yeah, we totally had a relation.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Real? So the real person was the actor in
Halloween 3.
Halloween 3.
Yeah.
Season of the Witch, right?
Yeah. Season of the Witch. And it's actually funny because you're like, you know, you watch Season of the Witch and you're laughing and you're just like, oh, kind of rolling your eyes.
Yeah.
And, but then at like the last like 20 minutes, it just really starts to get, it really starts to get to you. And you're just like, it's really creepy and effective.
Uh-huh.
And I think it would be, that would be a key, that would be a great movie to remake where you could just like iron out, smooth out the rough edges and like make it, you know, put better actors in there. And
right. Because it's a good concept, right?
It's a really good concept. It's a fun, you know, fun Videodrome-y almost
right.
concept.
Yeah,
so,
yeah. I look forward to this becoming a regular thing, having you on and doing horror movies.
I am happy to do so.
And we can do whatever. We don't have to do horror, but it's just, you can turn me on to so many new things.
I am all about, well, we were talking about Texas Chainsaw Massacre 2. Now that you've seen Texas Chainsaw Massacre for the first
right.
time and had the crap scared out of you,
uh-huh.
now you can see Texas Chainsaw Massacre 2 and have the crap scared out of you and laugh as well. Because
yeah,
it's really,
pretty bonkers, right?
It is bonkers. And it's, you know, it's Dennis Hopper versus Leatherface in a chainsaw battle.
That's all you need to say.
That's all you need to say. And it's like, chef's kiss, beautiful.
So, is I don't want to spoil it for myself, but is two? Because at the end of one, we see Leatherface just sort of. I mean, I guess he cuts his leg, but he's just sort of angrily doing his little shimmy shake with the chainsaw, and that's the last we see of him.
Yeah.
So, does two pick up right after one, or is it a totally new thing?
It picks up a ways after one, and
okay.
it's just like a little bit more. You know, that was just a very contained, that was very contained in a small, you know, group of people. And this is sort of them running loose in the in the Texas countryside, or you know, not really countryside, but what seems like it's around Austin. It's I mean, it's really fun. It's like
running loose in downtown Austin.
Yeah, take this, emos.
Yeah, Congress Street, you shall be mine. But we are here to talk about. Well, we can talk about whatever. But Evil Dead 2, originally, but I think in some of the press materials, Evil Dead 2, Dead by Dawn.
Yeah. It was like the official title is just Evil Dead 2,
right.
But the poster's tagline, Dead by Dawn, was such, you know, it really kind of became part of the, you know, part, it almost became a de facto part of the title because people thought of it that way.
And that's in the movie, you know, Dead by Dawn,
Dead by Dawn. We are the people, we are those who were and shall be again.
Oh, I actually wrote that line down. We might as well say it because it's so great. We are the things that were and shall be again. It's so good.
It's really funny how quotable the movie is. It's just like there's just so many little lines that, you know, pop up. If you listened to, you know, I listened to a fair amount of industrial and dance, like electronic music in the early 90s. And, you know, samples of Evil Dead were just pretty much inescapable.
Really?
Oh, yeah. Everybody, you know, there was...
Let's go.
Groovy. That was in like...
Oh, I'm sure.
Yeah, it was like, you know, Skinny Puppy, the Rolling Cox, the Shaman, you know, all those bands like just decided to build entire songs around Evil Dead samples. And it was, you know, it's pretty effective. It's a fun, you know. But yeah, so the whole story behind Evil Dead is pretty interesting. It's like a... Because this is like... This is their Sam Raimi's third movie with Bruce Campbell.
Right.
And third movie in general. Well... This is third theatrical release, I should say. They, Sam Raimi and Bruce Campbell and a bunch of other people, Scott Spiegel.
The Coen brothers.
The Coen brothers.
Sure.
The Coen brothers were involved with them, but they, like, a lot of these guys grew up, the Coen brothers grew up in Minneapolis, but there was a core group of people that grew up in Michigan and went to school together, and they made all these 8mm movies together.
Right.
And, you know, it's the kind of thing where... They would just get more and more complex, and then they'd start. They start with simple, fun movies, and they start to learn little editing tricks, and start and so on and so on. So by the time they were in college, they had figured out how to, you know, construct a story. Not always very well, but they figured out a lot of the tricks, and they
developed a style for sure.
Oh yeah, absolutely. Sam Raimi finally, Rob Tappert, who is their producer, started researching, like, well, how do we make a movie that we can sell? And they finally were like, well, let's do a horror movie. All these horror movies have made, you know, start out with low budgets with beginning directors and have made a profit. And
right.
So Sam Raimi was not really a huge, neither Sam Raimi nor Bruce Campbell were huge fans of the genre. They weren't like horror movies. Well, they're probably like bigger horror movie fans now, but at the time they're just like, eh, whatever, you know, we'll make a horror movie, why not?
Well, it's funny, that's still the case, and horror movies still stand as a very effective way to do a movie on the cheap.
Mm-hmm.
We were talking about this in one of the roundtables, you know, to do a slasher movie, you can go camping for a week and shoot a movie these days with a digital camera, as long as you have some attractive youngsters and a couple of knives and a good concept, you can still go out and do, and a lot of corn syrup and red dye.
Mm-hmm.
You can do some really good, like, it's got to be a good concept or else it's just trash.
Yeah.
But you can do it on the cheap.
Yeah. And there's like, you know, you don't need a giant set. You don't need anything. You can just like, in the case of the first Evil Dead, they just had a cabin in Tennessee that they went to that was not heated.
Yeah.
And they had a house that they were staying in.
Uh-huh.
Then while they were staying overnight at their house, some locals came and stole all the power tools. They left behind all the expensive editing or all the expensive like camera tools or camera equipment. But they stole their power tools. So Sam Raimi ended up spending the night in this freezing cabin in order to protect everything.
To guard the stuff?
Yeah. I've tried to sleep on a deflated air mattress, and it was like 60 degrees.
Yeah.
And I was like, this is not – yeah. I'm never doing this again.
I don't think we were talking off mic, and I started screaming, save it, even though it was my fault because I brought it up. But Evil Dead 1 is the one I'm least – that I've seen the least. I know I've seen it, and maybe even a couple of times, but I've seen Army of Darkness a lot.
Mm-hmm.
Probably my favorite, although Evil Dead 2 is right neck and neck.
Mm-hmm.
But I remember seeing Evil Dead 2 for the first time. This came out in 87, and I think I saw it at a midnight screening in, had to have been either 88 or 89
mm-hmm.
when I was a junior or senior in high school.
Wow.
And I wasn't, you know, we talked a bit about it. I wasn't horror movie kid, and I wasn't midnight movie kid. I just sort of got roped into it with friends. But I remember seeing it and just, like, not having ever seen anything like it before in my life.
Yeah, I remember the first time I saw it was in, like, early 1988,
mm-hmm.
but it wasn't theatrically. I think the last time I was here, I said we had one movie theater
right.
around me, and I just, you know.
They certainly didn't play Evil Dead 2.
They certainly did not play Evil Dead 2. But they had, you know, I went to a friend's house, and they had rented Evil Dead 2.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, at the time, I was watching horror. I was watching horror movies, but I always like to think I was smarter than the horror movies.
Right.
And so I was like, ugh, this is like, so, you know, I would watch Return of the Living Dead over and over again, and then Night of the Living Dead, and
yeah.
then all these movies. But I always thought that it would be like, you know, I was like, if you could see any of the seams, I'd be like, this movie's stupid.
Yeah.
And so, you know, we stayed.
Interesting, because that's so not you now.
Oh, no, no, no. Now, I had this lovely discussion with my wife, who says hello. She, by the way, I'd just like to do a quick plug for my wife.
Sure.
She's a cartoonist,
right.
and if you follow her at Hannah K. Garden, you can see some of her, like, she does diary and autobiographical stuff.
H-A-N-N-A-H-K Garden.
Yeah.
Okay.
And she has a Patreon as well. So, but you can, like, get a feel for it, and if you decide you want to throw a buck into the plate, you can just go to Patreon. It's, you know, there's no minimum. There's no minimum.
Yeah.
But anyway, we were talking about that, and it's like, it's very easy to just sort of shit on something
yeah.
and watch something and thinking you're smarter than it or you're mm-hmm. better than it. But it's hard to sit there and watch. It's a little bit more challenging, but ultimately more rewarding to watch something and say, well, what were they trying to do? How did this work? And mm-hmm. what did it, and you know, it's so, I mean, that's the case with Evil Dead 2. Like at the time I was like, I think we watched probably a Monty Python movie and then they threw on Evil Dead 2.
Mm-hmm.
And I think I made it to the dancing corpse scene and I was like, I gotta go. And, because I was like, it looks so fake. But it was, you know, now you watch
right.
it and you're just like, it's so amazing.
Yeah,
it's
yeah.
I respect the, you know, should we like, so that's, a, I mean, so that's the thing. I was like 18 years old and.
You didn't appreciate stop motion and Jason and the Argonaut style stop motion animation at the time probably.
No, not as much as
because it does
should.
Look fake and corny.
It does, but it's also amazing
yeah.
for what it, I mean, you know. I can't imagine being a kid now and watching stop motion because, you know, that's all practical effects. And with digital, you know, now with digital effects, you can replicate all that stuff.
Right.
Handle. You can make a realistic looking Thanos, for example.
Right.
But yeah, it's such a, it's a fun, I mean, it's such, I mean, I could sort of, I mean, of course I can, everybody can look back at their younger selves and
yeah.
kick themselves. I will forgive myself instead. Be like, you know what? You
yeah,
you tried. You
for did. Sure. my deal, and I talked a little bit about this on, I think, one of the roundtables or maybe just one of the minis with Noel. But I really, maybe more so than any other genre, completely just give myself up to it.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm all in.
Yeah.
Because I don't see what the point is. It's no fun at all to nitpick horror films.
Mm-hmm.
I don't see the point because maybe more so than any other genre, they are Nick Pittable. And it's sure, you can always do that.
Yeah.
But I don't see the point. I give myself up to a horror movie. I buy it all. I'm there for the fun and the ride. And even a movie like A Quiet Place, I'm not sure if you saw that one.
I didn't. And I don't, I think I'd like to go, I'd like to watch it now. I just remember seeing so many ads for, like, so many
yeah.
trailers for it. And I was just like,
it was overhyped for sure.
Yeah.
But a good, they call it, like, I think horror fans call it, like, a good starter horror, or,
mm-hmm.
if you're not into horror, watch this and you might like it.
Right.
But very much a movie you can pick holes in all over the place, as
but
well
why?
As things like Midsommar. But like just,
yeah.
and I had problems with that aren't nitpicky, but
yeah.
I give myself up to it when I go into the theater or watch one of these movies at home. I'm just there to have fun.
Yeah. And it's like, it's so easy, especially if you're, I mean, if you go to see a horror movie in a theater, I went to see, what was it? There were two like Facebook themed, Facebook style right. Movies that were released at the same
Unfriended
time.
And
Unfriended and one other one. Maybe Friend Request.
Blocked.
I can't remember. It was like, but one was like one they just made a sequel to. It was the good. It was the better of the two that they made. That they ended up making the sequel to.
Yeah, one of them was okay, right?
Yeah, it was good, and it was like I saw it in a Sunday matinee at noon, mm-hmm. and I was the only person in the theater, and I'm just like,
yeah, it's kind of scary, right?
Yeah. The only other time I saw a movie alone in a theater was Kangaroo Jack. When I
that was scary too.
Well, I snuck in. I had just I had watched a movie, one other movie. It's a theater in Brooklyn called the Pavilion, and it's like a three or four story right. theater.
Yeah.
And like nobody's up there watching. So I just like would watch, you know, I watched Confessions of a Dangerous Mind. And then I was listening outside the door, having heard Kangaroo Jack or having seen Kangaroo Jack once already.
Oh, really?
Yeah. I saw it twice in the theater. Snuck in the second time.
Oh, you forgive yourself for that, too.
It was, that's another story altogether. I do forgive myself for that, but we had so much fun watching that.
So, Evil Dead 2 had a budget of about $3.5 million.
Mm-hmm.
I have a few tidbits here. I'm sure you know all of this, but for the benefit of the listener, Stephen King basically talked Dino De Laurentiis into financing this movie because he loved Evil Dead so much.
Yeah,
and he was like, "You really should finance this film."
Mm-hmm.
Like the Sam Raimi guys, really, he's got it.
Yeah, they were having a hard time securing financing because Evil Dead was a success, but not a huge success.
Right,
and then their second movie, which Sam Raimi co-wrote with the Coen brothers, Crime Wave, was a pretty massive flop.
Have you seen that?
I haven't, but I
haven't either. I'm really intrigued by it, though.
I have a friend, Pete Mueller, who's a cartoonist in Madison, who stands by that. He's
really?
A huge fan of, he's a huge fan of Crime Wave.
Yeah, I need to check that out because, I mean, there's so much talent there. There's got to be something there.
Sure. I mean, Louise Lasser, Bruce Campbell, it's a, you know.
Yeah.
And the Coen brothers.
Yeah. And Sam Raimi.
And I've seen every other Coen brothers movie. Why wouldn't I see this? Well, I mean, for a long time, it's hard to find. But,
Scott Spiegel, who co-wrote this, I did not realize, but apparently at the time, he and Raimi shared a house with Joel and Ethan Coen, Fran McDormand, Holly Hunter, and Kathy Bates.
Yeah. That's nuts.
That is crazy.
It's just like, in fact, one of the characters, Bobby Cho, was actually written kind of with Holly Hunter in mind.
Yeah, I saw that.
Like there's a great tidbit on the audio commentary where Sam Raimi says, you know, he walked out, you know, he's used to seeing Holly Hunter like hang out wearing sweats and reading scripts. And
right.
one day he walks out and he sees she's like sort of dressed up and he's like, "Oh, Holly, you look really good." And she's uh-huh. like, "I am auditioning for the role of a prostitute, Sam. I don't consider that a compliment." It's like, "Oh, all right."
I really wanted to see this movie with Holly Hunter and Fran McDormand and Kathy Bates in it. Like, they all live together. Why, like...
Yeah,
how great would that have been? I mean, not to knock any of the actors, but
right.
they're all pretty second rate.
Well, okay,
is that fair to say or
I
no?
have a... I have a rating for them. Okay, should we talk about the plot before we get into the actors? Because I do
sure.
have like I do have a very strong opinion about two of the actors.
Okay.
Well, I mean, I have a strong opinion about all the actors, but
we can jump around. We can do it out of order. It doesn't matter.
Okay. Well,
this is Freeform Radio.
So let's talk about like the whole idea of Evil Dead was four friends go to a cabin, mm-hmm. or five friends go to a cabin.
The first Evil Dead.
Yeah, the first Evil Dead. And an evil force possesses, they find a tape recorder with an audio recording of the Book of the Dead.
Yeah.
They play it and summon this evil force who apparently, you know, I don't know why it ever went away, really, because it was summoned once before enough
right.
to be on audio. Anyway, nitpicking. I mean, it's kind of – it is also fun to nitpick, though. Let's
well,
be honest. Sometimes it's fun.
If it's in jest,
yeah.
it can be fun, but just not one of those guys that's like, meh,
yeah.
meh.
Sneering at it.
Yeah.
But it's you know, the evil force comes and, mm-hmm. like, possesses and kills, you know, all of them except for Bruce Campbell, who
right.
at the very end is, like, the evil force breaks through the cabin and, like, hits him square, and that's where it ends. You
right.
don't know what happens.
That's right. Ash.
Ash. This – Evil Dead 2 kind of like recaps everything. It's funny because like it is such a taut, it's like only 87 minutes long.
Yeah, it gets started very fast.
Yeah, you get like 40 seconds of exposition with a little, the sort of...
Swirly.
Yeah, the swirly background.
Which
and
is just great.
Yeah, which is beautiful. Legend has it.
Yeah.
It was written by the Dark Ones. Necronomicon Ex Mortis, roughly translated the Book of the Dead.
It's just so fun.
Yeah. So there's 40 seconds of exposition, and then... It's like 2 minutes of credits, and then it cuts to a couple, Ash and Linda, different Linda from the first movie because they couldn't get her back in, apparently, driving to the cabin. Oh, incidentally, they wanted to just use footage from the original, but it had been licensed to so many territories that they couldn't get they couldn't get the rights to it, so they just like, all right, we'll just reshoot with two people instead of five. So they go...
The bridge.
Yeah.
It's like that car and that bridge is just so iconic now, all these years later.
It is. It's like, it's so... I mean, it looks like a model, but it's so beautiful. And it's just like, and it really...
What is it? Do you know how they did that?
I think that's a model. I think that's just, that's a model. The second one where the bridge is destroyed is a matte painting.
Okay.
But...
Where it looks like a giant claw.
Yeah.
Which is great.
Yeah, it's really well done. So... Yeah, so they like have another 40 seconds of dialogue where they explain that they're going to this cabin and they hope it's the owners don't come back.
Mm-hmm.
They go into the cabin. She starts changing. Oh, he gives her this.
I'm a man and you're a woman.
At least last time I checked. Ba-da-ba. And it's also this great scene of him playing piano.
Oh, really man. Can we just talk about Bruce Campbell for 1 second?
So good.
Like, one of the best physical actors and face actors, like, in the history of movies, I think.
Yeah.
The whole sequence with the hand, which we'll get to in more detail, I think you take it for granted how well done that is and how great he is.
Every time I watch it, I'm amazed. But have you ever met Bruce Campbell?
I have not. I have an autographed picture that a friend got me many years ago that I cherish. I've never met him.
I myself and some other people co-wrote a vampire book about 8 years ago, maybe 9, 10 years ago.
Oh, that's right.
Yeah.
What's the name of it?
The New Vampire's Handbook.
Right.
A guide, basically it's a how-to book by the vampire Miles Proctor. It's still in print, oddly enough.
Yeah, you can get it, right?
Yeah, you can. I'm surprised it's still in print, though. But, you know, it's good for what it is.
Uh-huh.
I stand by it. We did a lot of research in that.
Yeah.
So we were doing as much promoting as we could. So we went to some horror conventions, and I went to a horror convention with my friend Janet, and we got up like early morning because we're like, let's go to the gym. Which is sort of a weird, sounds strange for me to do that, but it's like, so we're on the second floor of this hotel. We push the button. And because it's like, we could have just taken the stairs. It would have been so much easier to do that. But we push the button and the elevator door opens and Bruce Campbell is in there.
Wow.
And we're just like, I just felt really embarrassed because I'm just like, I apologize. It's just too early in the morning for us. We just didn't even think about it. And he's like, well, the good thing is we'll still get to where we're going. And he was very gracious about it. And that was my only encounter with him. And, you know. I really want to like pick Hodgman's brain about his Campbell experience.
Yeah, because he's had a couple, I think.
Well,
right?
He repped his book, I think.
Oh, that's right.
And I'm just that had to be either really fun or just one of those things where it's just maybe
he writes a little bit about it in his new book. Actually,
I have to read. You mean
medallion
status available now at finer bookstores.
Bit.ly, all capitals. It's great. I just finished it. It's a really wonderful book, actually.
Excellent.
Back to the plot points, I guess. They got this set up, and we meet the new Linda, right?
Right. Meet the new Linda.
Terrible hair.
Terrible hair.
On the new Linda.
Pretty good. I mean, pretty good actress. Not great, but she's fine.
Sure.
I mean, she's not really doing a whole lot in it. He plays the tape. She gets possessed, or she, like, gets removed from the house, then gets possessed.
Yeah.
And... She doesn't even like try to. She's like sort of like menacing him, like sort of like almost Frankenstein style, like his arm stretched out, and she jumps. He grabs a shovel and knocks her head clean off.
This is in the first 5 minutes of the movie.
Yeah,
it's fantastic.
Yeah, as they refer to it as recap the decap.
And we also get our first look in the early on of the board cam, which I'm sure you know about this, but for people listening, all those shots of with a camera running through the woods, what they did was they just mounted a camera on a board and ran with it.
Yeah, one person on each end.
Yeah. You hold it low to the ground. Yeah. It has a sort of shaky look, so it's not steady cam at all.
Mm-hmm.
But man, it's so effective, and it became such a Raimi staple, and then later a Coen Brothers staple, like it's all over Raising Arizona.
Yeah.
That same exact, you know, technique.
It's interesting. I mean, because I think that's the good thing is that Raimi just was playing around with 8mm and Super 8 mm-hmm. cameras for so long that he's just like, oh, let's try this.
Right.
So it's like the stakes were so low that he just had a good sense of what could be done with them.
Yeah, and it's the board cam is all throughout this movie and some of the best stuff.
Yeah.
When it's, you know, one of my favorite sequences is when it starts in the woods and goes all the way through, busting through the doors of the cabin.
Uh-huh.
And then Bruce Campbell is spinning through the forest and then against the tree and finally into the puddle.
Oh, and that scene.
I have no idea how they did that.
I read up on it. Bruce Campbell was like mounted to like a sort of an iron cross.
Wow.
He died for our sins. sorry, Chuck's parents.
But they don't listen to this.
So he's sort of mounted to an iron cross. It was on a crane and it was like spinning.
So they really did.
They had it was like they shot this part in South Carolina. It was
North Carolina.
No, well, this one they shot in South Carolina.
Oh, that actual scene?
Yeah.
Oh, okay.
It was like a 3/4 mile stretch of road.
Gotcha.
And they shot it. They undercranked so it like it would speed up. It took uh-huh. 20 minutes to drive this 3/4 mile with them spinning it and like he'd be whacked with branches.
Yeah,
and,
so they set all that up?
Yeah. And apparently the shoot took all day to do it. So Bruce Campbell's, you know, was strapped to—
spinning.
Yeah. Oh, my God.
It looks so good, though.
It does. And then he, like, crashes down to the ground. It's just so, it's so amazing how, like, the camera tricks they used and how effective
they were. Yeah, the creativity was just off the charts.
Yeah.
They were inventing stuff on the fly.
Sure. And it's easy, you know, it's easy to, like, set up a camera in front of, like, a horror action.
Yeah.
But they conveyed it with these great camera tricks and these great, like, you know, practical effects that were that really sort of like set you a little bit off kilter.
Yeah, and it was just so original and fresh. A lot of this stuff has been copied in a much more slick fashion over the years.
Yeah,
but that original stuff, and this is in the 80s, kind of mid to late 80s. I do want to talk about the cabin real quick. And again, I'm sure you know this stuff, but they shot in Wadesboro, North Carolina,
mm-hmm.
largely. So I'm in Michigan. But the Steven Spielberg had shot The Color Purple in Wadesboro.
Mm-hmm.
So they used the big farmhouse from The Color Purple as their production offices. They built the exterior facade of the cabin. Not facade, just the, you know, the cabin without an interior, mm-hmm. basically, in the woods. And then built everything else, the interior, on a stage. Well, not a stage, inside of a junior high school.
In a gymnasium in the J.R. Faison Junior
That's
High School.
Right. But I was, you know, I started to dig in a little bit about the cabin and like, is it still there? And I'm sure you know this stuff, but, you know, it eventually just sort of crumbled, but was just left there.
Yeah.
And the homeowner now said he didn't care about it, and he allowed this Evil Dead fan to go in and just take what he wanted. And a few years ago, this dude got a box truck and salvaged whatever he could from the cabin.
Oh,
and,
my God.
And at some point, a lot of it was just rotted and, like, kind of done and you couldn't do anything with. But he did get the triangular exterior facade
mm-hmm.
and put it on eBay for $1,400.
Wow.
And, you know, you don't get a follow-up on eBay stuff. It's, you could probably track it down, but
I'm a subscriber to a service that allows me to do just that, actually.
Well, find out, because the last I saw was it's up and there's one bid for $1,400 and I've never heard anything else.
Yeah. Well, the interesting thing is, like, when the force, like, is chasing Bruce Campbell around the cabin, you know, it's clearly the interior is not is bigger than it's like a TARDIS. It looks a lot bigger on the inside than it does on the on the outside. But when that, like, they use a wide angle lens and you can see that there's no, you know, there's no ceiling.
Yeah.
And you can kind of see some lighting rigs and you can cut like—
Oh, really?
I mean, it's only after I watched the commentary uh-huh. that I noticed it, because I was like,
did
oh, yeah.
Did they blot it out?
Yeah, because it's like you are so sucked into
it. Oh, yeah. I didn't notice any of that.
Yeah, it's funny that Bruce Campbell, that Ash is able to outrun the evil force and just sort of like quickly duck into the root cellar.
Well, I think the fact that they built it on a stage, it sort of lent itself to this quality that I really like about the movie, and that it did look kind of fake.
Mm-hmm.
It didn't feel like a real cabin in the woods, mm-hmm. which is – it works better for some reason.
Even though it is almost it's not a perfect replica, but it is a very close replica of the cabin they shot – real cabin they used in the first Evil Dead.
Right.
They did – they did all kinds of – they built it with all kinds of trick walls, uh-huh. and they built the – it was like two levels, so you could actually have a root cellar underneath the cabin. So,
yeah.
Oh, gosh, there's so many.
You can see the money. Like, it doesn't look slick, but it doesn't look cheap.
No.
Like, you can see the $3.5 million
mm-hmm.
In a very Sam Raimi way, but you can tell it wasn't a bunch of friends in the woods with $500,000, you know?
Right. In Evil Dead, you can kind of see that, but it's still pretty, I mean.
Still works.
Yeah, it still works. It's pretty effective. So, yeah, so meanwhile, Linda, he buries Linda, then he gets possessed, drives it away because he sees this cheap necklace that he got for Linda. It's a little magnifying glass. I think that was one of the three original props that made it from Evil Dead.
The tape recorder was another, right?
Tape recorder, the necklace, and the clock, the three.
Right.
The tape recorder was actually belonged to Sam Raimi's dad.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Reel to reel. So cool.
Panasonic.
Oh, was it?
Yeah. I don't know why I remembered that. That's like one of those extraneous details. It's just like, oh, it's a Panasonic. Okay. File that away and force out some math that I might need later.
So he hauls ass out of there. And that's another great sequence is the reverse car shot. When he gets to the bridge that has been destroyed.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, he's like, he gets there and there's a blue screen. That blue screen is so cheesy but works so well.
Yeah.
Where he's like, hits him in the foreground and this giant setting sun right behind him.
Uh-huh.
And it's just, it's so good.
Yeah, it does. It looks great.
He looks terrified.
Uh-huh.
And then they, cuts to the – then we have like 40 more seconds of exposition where they introduce the characters of Ed – and of Ed and Annie Noby, the professor's daughter.
Right.
And the professor's daughter
tube and – socks and cardigan sweater.
Oh, my God.
It's like right out of the preppy handbook.
Well, it's funny, too, because like I think Annie is – like Sarah Barry played Annie. I think she's really good. I think she's – well, pretty good. Her scream, though, is A+.
Yeah, yeah. She's a good horror movie actor, I think.
Yeah. Meanwhile, Richard Domler.
I don't know. He's not great.
Ed is not great. But he is, he went on to be a QVC host and it kind of shows.
Oh, really?
The whole idea behind him.
That's so perfect.
They wanted somebody that seemed like he could, seemed like he was sort of like this sort of little bit macho, a little bit like a tough guy that could sort of save the day.
I can fight an evil force.
Yeah. And so when he gets killed almost immediately, it's like it has more of an impact. But he didn't come off that way. He just seemed really dated and, you know.
Yeah.
That's okay. He seemed like a QVC host.
He seemed like an 80s high school villain.
Yeah. Oh, that's the line I wrote down. It's like, what has he found in the Book of the Dead? That's more, that's definitely more stilted than he did. So I'm
barely.
Yeah. Probably nothing, but possibly the doorway to another world. And he has this sort of like, like nods and, huh.
Yeah, he's pretty bad.
Yeah.
Another thing that really hit me in this film, too, was how great the sound design is. And not only the sound, because the sound is amazing, but his use of silence contrasting with the sound is just so effective. There's so many shots that are completely silent.
Yeah.
That one great 360-degree shot in silence that looks around the whole scene and then back on his face again. And there's another couple toward the end, too.
Yeah.
And you're just David Lynch is always someone whose sound design I really love a lot. And I think that he I have a feeling he's influenced a little bit by some of this stuff.
Yeah. It's amazing how many people are actually like – you know, I have a really weird relationship with art, like music and film. Like I – like this is – like it, with a lot of like film, I should say, not most – not all of them. Not like Star Wars where I'm like, I have this cute little indie. It's called Star Wars that I really love a lot. But – you know, I have this relationship with some movies like Evil Dead 2 where I'm always like, oh, he saw that? That's so crazy.
Mm-hmm.
But apparently James Cameron when it was in the theaters, pulled up to Bill Paxton's house in his car, like knocked on his door. He's like, come on, we got to go see this movie. It's called Evil Dead 2.
No way.
Yeah. And so that's, Bill Paxton told him that later when they were working on A Simple Plan together.
Uh-huh. Another movie I loved.
Yeah, that was so good. He's such a good director.
I read that book too. I was really into Simple Plan.
I never read the book. Who is it? Do you remember who the author was?
I don't remember. I want to say his name was Scott something. It was good.
Okay.
And I read it after the movie because I like the movie so much.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. I miss Bridget Fonda.
Yeah. Why isn't she doing more?
She enjoyed being a family person and being a mom. And you know, she's married to Danny Elfman. So.
Oh, yeah. She didn't need
to work. And there's a lot, you know, there's a lot to be said for
she's
not acting.
She's rolling in Oingo Boingo money.
Yeah, that's where he made all this dough.
but then we get the great sequence with Linda coming back from the dead after coming back once previously, where they have that great dance, like where her corpse rises out of her, like headless corpse rises out of the grave.
This is the first stop motion, right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
And it's like, and interesting thing about the stop motion, this whole dance scene was choreographed by one of Sam Raimi's theater instructors in college.
I thought you were going to say by Paula Abdul.
No, Tony Basil worked on it. And then it was the stop motion was done by a man named Doug Beswick, mm-hmm. who you might have known from such other stop motion classics as Gumby and David and Goliath.
Wow.
Which is so weird to think that the guy that made David and Goliath. Like he made that he worked on a sort of a nude, rotting corpse dancing around.
Yeah, I guess it was a pretty short list of people to go to.
Yeah. Well, he also worked on Star Wars. It wasn't like he was exclusively working on Christian claymation shows.
Right.
But he did a lot of other work prior to that. And then she comes back. There's this great scene where she's like her severed head.
Mm-hmm.
She grabs him and is like, dance with me, and starts like bashing his head into a board.
Yeah.
And then he's like, oh, it zooms out of his like screaming face to reveal he's just sitting in an armchair. So it was a dream. Or was it? Because then a severed head falls into his lap,
right.
Bites him on the hand, and then he's like running around smashing.
That's one of the great sequences of this movie.
So it's such,
when he's got the head on his hand.
Yeah. It's like such great physical comedy of him like just smashing and smashing.
Oh, man. I have all caps written down, scene where she bites his hand. And that's where you also get one of the great moments of the movie, Workshed.
Workshed. Do you know the little tidbit about the Workshed line?
The Kurt Russell thing?
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, tell everyone. It's a great story.
Kurt Russell, Bruce Campbell became a successful actor after this as well. I mean, he was a successful actor so far as I'm concerned. But, you know, he worked with Kurt Russell on Escape from L.A.,
mm-hmm.
which was the watchable but not great sequel to Escape from New York.
Yeah, the sequel that's years later that somehow looked worse than the one many years before.
Yeah, like the giant surfing that giant wave.
Yeah, it was bad.
So the first thing that Kurt Russell says to Bruce Campbell on the set is, hey, say Workshed.
It's so funny.
Because it's just like such a, like the sound of it is just boosted so much. It's a Workshed. And it's like his lips don't sync up with it. And
yeah.
So,
I mean, if you haven't seen the movie, it's a part where they clearly just did some ADR, some additional dialogue recording, and dubbed in him saying Workshed, which they didn't even really need to do. The idea was he just wanted to telegraph to the audience.
He was going to the Workshed.
He was going to the Workshed, which he could have just done. But it became known as such a sort of hokey, bad dub that, you know, years later, Kurt Russell kind of gave him shit about it, which I love that, you know, it became such a thing that Kurt Russell knew about it.
Yeah, and Kurt Russell also saw and enjoyed Evil Dead 2.
Yeah, exactly. That's fantastic.
But
it does – that's where we get to the Shed, which is a very key set in this movie.
Mm-hmm.
The Shed is amazing. You've got Freddy Krueger's gloves hanging above the door, mm-hmm. which is a nice little Easter egg.
Yeah.
Because in Nightmare on Elm Street, Nancy falls asleep watching The Evil Dead on TV. So I heard this was just a little bit of, I don't even want to say the words quid pro quo right now, but a little thank you in return to Wes Craven.
Well, prior to that, in Evil Dead, they had in the basement, they had a torn a poster of The Hills Have Eyes, which is
so it
torn
all started
in half.
There, huh?
It started there, but I think they were sort of doing that as a little bit of an FU to Wes Craven, because in The Hills Have Eyes, there was a torn Jaws poster. And like, they thought
how deep does it go?
Well, they read that as like he's saying he's like the new master of horror. Well, this is better than Spielberg. Well, nuts to that. And then so they did the torn Hills Have Eyes poster, and then they're like,
that's probably not even what Wes Craven meant.
No. No, not at all.
Like ripping Jaws in half.
No. It's, I think when you're 20, in your early 20s,
sure.
I've taken umbrage to so many stupid things. And
right.
Now looking back, I'm just like, what was I so mad about?
It's like everyone is the enemy. work shed.
Yeah, work shed. And then comes the other great line, chainsaw.
Yeah.
He has Linda's head in the vise and he's like, pulls back the curtain, sees a chalk outline where a chainsaw
so
should
great.
Be. Chainsaw. And then all of a sudden the door bursts open and it's like the headless corpse jiggling up and down with a chainsaw over its head.
I love the chalk outline thing. Just that to me embodies what I love about Sam Raimi's sense of fun and play.
Yeah.
To have a chalk outline, just to indicate that there was once a chainsaw there,
mm-hmm.
is so unbelievable and so silly, but just so fun.
And it works because you just don't even think about it because you're so wrapped up in the moment.
Yeah.
It's like, I think that's the thing. You should if you're making a film, you should always just be like, give the audience you should be confident in your ability to make the audience suspend their disbelief,
mm-hmm.
Because otherwise it's like, that's too fake. It's like, nobody's going to care if you're, either laughing yourself silly or pooping your pants. So,
right.
But the headless Linda was such a great, it was just pretty much a mannequin on a pole.
Uh-huh.
And, very expensive, well-crafted mannequin.
Right.
They were jiggling up and down on a pole.
Oh, really?
Yeah, and spinning around. And, and then they... he pulls out the, he pulls out the chainsaw, pulls off her arm with the chainsaw.
Uh-huh.
Linda reverts back. That's an interesting thing because there's a lot of continuity problems with the amount of gore that's on Ash.
Always.
Yeah.
It's fine.
It is. It's like you don't if you're looking, again, if you're looking to poo-poo it, you can find somebody to poo-poo.
Are they continuity problems though, or did he just not care and it just was part of the thing?
Apparently they did care. But they didn't know, they shot it out of order, so they didn't know how much would be.
So they really were continuity errors.
Yeah, and the continuity, what is the continuity, it's not the continuity director, but the continuity.
The scripty, supervisor.
She apparently was just constantly mortified. She's like, we can't do this. That furniture is out. Nobody, and Sam Raimi's like, nobody's going to do
right.
this.
Right. I mean, most notably, there's so much blood in some of these scenes.
Mm-hmm.
Like Shining style coming from the walls, coming from the cellar.
Yeah.
The green blood that goes all over everything.
Mm-hmm. Black bile blood.
So effective.
Yeah.
But none of that stuff in subsequent shots is on the walls. And I just kind of thought that they just didn't care.
Yeah. I think it's like after a certain point, you don't care. And
yeah.
it's like you can't keep a slicked, wet, wet surface around if you're going to be acting on it.
For days and days and weeks.
Yeah. And then it cuts.
It goes back to her. She comes back to real Linda.
Yeah, she goes back to real Linda and begs for her life. And then it cuts back to possessed Linda. And she's like, her mouth is covered with bile because there was a scene where she spat black bile at him.
Yeah.
But I think it's actually more effective that she didn't spit the black bile in the version we saw. I'm sorry. Now it's good. There's so many little things that I can just get into.
Well, I think one cool choice in that scene was when he did finally chainsaw the head. It's you just see it in shadow.
Yeah.
Which was very effective and cool.
Yeah. A lot of there's a lot of real violence, but a lot of it is implied as well. They were shooting for an R rating, which is why they used black bile and green blood. And they had a yellow blood at one point. But they finally were like, this is not going to be. This is not going to be an R-rated movie.
Mm-hmm.
And so they released it. So they set up a fake company called Rosebud Releasing. It wasn't a fake company. It was a real company. Because if you were working with the MPAA, you were forbidden from releasing an unrated movie. So they had to set up a dummy company to release it in theaters. And of course,
as an unrated?
Yeah, as unrated. And it's, if you know much about, I don't know how it is now, but at the time, in the 80s and 90s, you could not like a lot of the chains wouldn't touch unrated movies. Mm-hmm. So you couldn't get into like the Marcus Amphitheater or the Marcus Theaters or any of those small chains, small or large chains, because they wouldn't release it. So it had to be in like independent theaters, which ultimately hurt the, you know, hurt their bottom line.
Right. Although it did, I think it ended up grossing about $6 million,
which is, you know,
close to double their money, which isn't bad.
Yeah.
And then much more in
home video. Yeah. And, you know, I mean, they kept alive an entire video company for, you know, they kept alive. Evil Dead movies kept Anchor Bay afloat for about a decade.
Oh, is that what it was?
Oh, Anchor Bay. Yeah. They were just like, because they had like, they would just keep releasing different editions of the Evil Dead movies. Here's the Book of the Dead version. Here's the single disc. Here's the double disc.
So the Linda scene, though, that also introduces what would become a repeated thing with Ash and Bruce Campbell having these great one-liners.
Mm-hmm.
And I think the first one is right there where he goes, "You're going down." And Ash becomes kind of this superhero throughout the three films, like more and more, and just gets known for these iconic lines, especially in Army of Darkness.
Yeah.
Is where it goes, you know, like to 11, you know?
Yeah. It's like a lot of – he's channeling a lot of Clint Eastwood, it seems. Like
yeah.
His voice drops down a little bit like and it gets a little bit raspy.
The blood on the light bulb shot too, I really appreciated.
Yeah.
In that when the blood
– splashes up and hits the light
bulb.
Yeah,
and then they put the red gel over the lights and everything.
Yeah.
And it's really, really cool.
It's fun. It's and then they go in and it's like – well, the thing about like the first 35 minutes of the movie, 21 minutes is just Bruce Campbell.
Yeah.
Like it's just him acting with like puppets or acting to him like with himself. And it's just like, and that includes like the 2 minutes of credits. So it was just a really, you know, a lot of this is just like little sight gags that they would get, you know, that they pulled up. Like the rocking chair, the creaking rocking chair that's just like, you know, a creaking rocking chair just seems so hokey in a ghost movie, but at the same time, it just like it swivels and it just starts creaking. And the sound design is both a creak and Sam Raimi's voice below, like, so it sounds extra creepy. There's like the mirror gag, which you don't expect, where he's like, "I'm fine, I'm fine." He's looking in a mirror.
That's so good.
And then he just like reaches out of the, like, he or an evil version of him reaches out the meter, is like, "We just cut up our girlfriend with a chainsaw." Yeah. Does that sound fine to you?
Yeah, it's so good, man. This movie just gets more and more bonkers as it goes.
Yeah.
Well, then we meet Bobby Joe and who's the other guy? Who's the overall guy?
Jake. This is where I would like to put in my pitch. The secret sauce of this movie is Bobby Joe, played by Cassie Wesley.
Mm-hmm.
She is so good in this. Like, you're just like, she went on to like be a soap actor. And
oh,
it's
really?
Like, yeah. It's like she knows, like, she's one of the people that knows exactly what kind of movie she's making.
Uh-huh.
She's just like, she plays it kind of serious, but she's also like overblown, like, you know.
That first tobacco spit she does.
It's so good, yeah.
It's so funny and kind of corny.
What do you want to go there for?
Yeah, and she doesn't
know
look,
your
I
business.
Mean, she appears miscast because she doesn't look like anyone who would be with Jake or any, you know, she doesn't look like some woodland redneck. You know, she's kind of dolled up and sort of attractive.
Yeah.
And but it works somehow.
Yeah, it works so well. I think like that's what I mean. It's like you don't think about her as being out of place in it.
Right.
I mean, it must kind of, you know, you've spoken on the show about how Southern accents are often
terrible.
Poorly done and terrible. And so that must kind of like rub you the wrong way a little bit to hear
that.
Well,
but it was so like kind of corny and it didn't bother me.
Yeah. And they also set up there's also a great line where Jake is like, "Oh, there's a trail. I can take you there for 45. And Bobby Joe nudges him, $100. And it just sets up. She's like, "Well, I'll tell you what. You take my bags. You've got a deal."
Right.
And he thinks it's just one little bag. It turns out to be this giant trunk. It was introduced. Oh, that's like the smoky. That's like Chekhov's trunk.
Right.
They introduced it only so they could have a gag later where Jake is like hauling it over this trail.
Yeah, pretty much.
Well,
then we get to the hand stuff.
Yeah.
Which is that whole sequence, like I said, is so easy to take for granted because you've seen it so many times. but how brilliant Bruce Campbell is in that scene and how he animates his hand in such a way that you forget it's part of his body.
Mm-hmm.
It becomes a character.
Yeah. It's like the way it's like sort of flopping around, yeah, like grabbing at these plates, which are apparently unglazed. They were unglazed pottery, so they would break easily, uh-huh, more easily.
Yeah, yeah.
So it's like, ksh, like just so smashing good plates over his head. And then when he's finally knocked out, he's just like gonna, like the hand is gonna like hit him with one more plate, and then it's like, whoa! And they're like, uh-huh, and it's like spies in finger quotes, a meat cleaver.
Yeah.
And it's like, then it starts just like, it's like the way his hand, and then it just drags him.
Oh, it's so good.
And then, like, it drags him right when he's about at the meat cleaver. Bruce Campbell stabs him in the hand. Uh-huh. He's like, who's laughing now? Yeah. Starts the chainsaw, cuts off his own hand. Who's laughing now?
Oh, ah! So great.
Just like, you don't see the violence, but you just see the blood splattering,
yeah,
on his.
So effective.
Yeah.
I thought the one thing about this movie that I loved was, and it, for some reason, doesn't take me out of it, but I love in movies like this where I'm constantly picturing the manpower off screen doing stuff.
Yeah.
Like in this case, the people, like the two guys that are clearly shoving Bruce Campbell across the floor inch by inch while the hand appears to move him.
Mm-hmm.
Or later on when he and I think it's he and Jake are laying on top of the cellar door.
And somebody like having to
push it. And someone's underneath like, yeah, pushing these guys up.
Yeah.
I just love picturing, like, that's just hands-on filmmaking that I just love so much, you know, mm-hmm, practical effects, someone just off camera, like pulling a body that you never see.
And right.
It's just some of my favorite stuff in film.
Well, it's interesting too, because as a PA, you know, you're there a lot of times. If you're a PA, I assume you're just there like, well, this is a job and I got to do this. And,
right,
you know, it's hard to be like, I can't understand what the vision is, but okay, I'll just shove on this uh-huh door. But it, yeah, it
you
all
get
looks
to do some cool stuff, man. I got to do some really cool shit as a PA.
What's the most fun you had?
Oh, I mean, I got to work on a Michael Bay commercial one time that was a lot of fun because you are invisible as a PA to Michael Bay. He doesn't turn his ire on you because you don't exist.
Mm-hmm.
So you can have a front row seat to the madness and him screaming at people and getting in, like pitching these little baby fits on set. You can be 4 feet away just watching and he doesn't even see you. He doesn't turn around and go, "You, what are you looking at?"
Uh-huh.
Like you just don't exist. So it was great. But I got to do a lot of cool stuff like that. Like, mm-hmm, I was oftentimes the guy off screen, you know, playing catch with the pro baseball player or whatever. You know, I got to play catch with Chipper Jones one time. You know, he's one of my baseball heroes.
Mm-hmm.
But I guarantee you there's some dude that's like our age or probably a little bit older right now that's like, you know what, I was the guy who was shoving Bruce Campbell across the floor in Evil Dead 2.
And the way horror conventions work, that guy probably has a table at those conventions. Just being like, guy, and people like, $20 to get his signature. All right.
Oh, that's so good. Then we get the farewell to arms joke.
Oh, gosh, yeah.
Which is so on the nose and fun.
It is like, here's your new home.
Right.
He puts a bucket over the hand and puts a stack of books, including a farewell to arms. It's just...
The other thing Campbell does in this movie that's very impressive is he pulls off that amazing feat of acting that's so hard to do, which is talking to yourself.
Yeah.
Realistically.
Even when it's like ludicrous dialogue, like, old double barrel here.
Yeah.
Gotta blow your butts to kingdom come. See if we don't.
It's so good. Only Bruce Campbell, I feel like, could have pulled that off.
Yeah.
Even though he was kind of nobody at the time.
Yeah. I mean, it's like you have to be very self-aware and very self-unaware at the same time where you're just, yeah, like, I know what this is going to look like and uh-huh I just have to be like, you know, I just have to not care.
Well, and he was so, he was such a leading man that never became one.
Yeah.
Like so handsome and just, and big and broad-shouldered. Like he had it all, but he chose like to go this other route with his career.
But he did carry two TV shows, you know, he was on
Briscoe County
Jr.
Which I really enjoyed actually.
And Jack of All Trades.
I don't know about that.
That was one of the, I mean, Sam Raimi had a long career after, you know, well, not after his movies because he still made movies, but mm-hmm, in the late, like the mid to late 90s, he made like Xena, Warrior Princess. He made
right,
Hercules, uh-huh, Cleopatra 2025, Jack of All Trades.
What I think was that?
They were all like
what
just
was Jack of All Trades.
It was like a syndicated action movie, and or syndicated action series. I don't remember anything about it. I just remember it was on, and I didn't really watch much of it, which I regret now. But
do you watch, or did you watch the TV show, the Ash TV show?
I watched most of it.
Yeah, I don't know why I didn't.
It's good. I think it's really good.
Really?
I think one of the guys from Derek Comedy writes for it. Derek Comedy is like, I can't remember his name, but there's DC Pearson, who's a young adult novelist now. Uh-huh. And this Donald Glover.
the voice of God.
Thank you. Because I was like, I was thinking about it. I was like, who? Because at first I was like, Corey Glover. I was like, no, Corey Glover's from Living Color. Crispin Glover. No, it's not Crispin Glover. Yeah, Donald Glover.
Danny Glover? No, not Danny Glover.
Yeah, it's funny.
Yeah, I need to watch some of that TV show, though. I don't know why I didn't.
I think it's really good. It's fun. It's a lot more comedy, and it's a lot, you know, it's a lot more comedy horror and, mm-hmm. you know, less horror than comedy. But it's a fun, you know, it's a fun watch, and it's on Netflix right now.
What do you think about the transition from horror to comedy as this series progressed?
I think this is my favorite. I mean, this is my favorite of the series. Mm-hmm. I think this is like the good – I think this is my favorite because it's like – it's a good bridge between the two, mm-hmm. between the like the straight horror, the straight low-budget horror of the first and like the higher-budget stop-action mayhem of the mm-hmm. The third.
Of Army of Darkness.
Yeah.
I really loved Army of Darkness.
It's fun. I need to watch it again. Mm-hmm. I think it's like – I think it's good, but it's just like – it's also interesting because like I think the character of Ash really changed so much. Mm-hmm. Like they – I can't tell if they really – listening to the commentary track, it seems like they kind of hate Ash in a way. Like they think he's a – they don't mind putting him through all the the tortures because they – you know, it seems like they all just sort of think he's a dope.
Yeah.
But I never get that from – you know, until Army of Darkness, you're like, oh, he's like just a giant blowhard. And,
right.
You know, but you don't get that from like the first two movies. He's just
yeah.
Like,
I mean, they kind of make him into a superhero by the end of it.
Yeah.
You know, with his shirt ripped open and the great sequence where he and when you know, which we'll get to it here in a second, yeah. but when he straps the chainsaw to his nub and cuts off the barrel of the shotgun yeah. and has everything rigged up.
That whole MacGyver sequence. Oh, this so is just good. Like, which is like I would never you know how to do that. I mean, if I were like. I mean, of course, I would never, you know, because it can't be done. But it's like, you know, just like having the presence of mind to actually like craft a, I mean, you know, let's just skip that part.
Okay.
It's like a little bit, but anyway.
Well, in the timeline of the film, though, where the blood from the wall scene, when he shoots the hand in the wall and then just the fire hose of blood
yeah.
in several different spots mm-hmm. comes out at him.
Right. And then they did some which were very... Like were in there where they had like literally like hoses of blood like shooting at him, but then they decided that wasn't enough, and so they they built. I think when they went back to Michigan for reshoots, they did one where it was a they flipped the set 90 degrees.
Uh-huh.
He was like, you just saw him. He was lying on a board or something like that, and they just had a 55-gallon drum with like a bag of like blood. They just like ripped open. And just like. Flooding him. I mean, that
wow.
really had to be hard on his breathing.
Yeah, I'm sure. It's like bloodboarding.
Yeah.
and then we had the laughing room sequence.
Right. With his, that was actually
so fun.
Based on a, it was based on a joke that they, you know, they were doing, the co-writer Scott Spiegel was doing this sort of like, he had the gooseneck lamp and he's like, uh-huh. like just doing that to Sam Raimi just to make him laugh. He's like, we're going to put that in there.
Oh, wow.
And they did the whole thing. They, you know, turned the whole room. And it is like both hilarious and it's really unsettling.
Yeah, it is. It works on both. I mean, unsettling like when the deer head comes alive.
Yeah.
But then so silly when Bruce Campbell's doing like the leg bends yeah. along with the lamp.
yeah. And he's like, he's laughing until finally he's just like stops laughing. He's just like starts screaming. Ah!
Yeah.
Ah! And then everything shuts. There's a noise outside. Everything shuts down.
Yeah. Another use of silence.
Yeah. And he just shoots.
Yeah.
And then there's like silence, silence, silence. Opens the door and is tackled by Jake. But there's a great thing where he's like, he's clearly... As they pointed out in the director's commentary, like you can clearly see if you were standing at the door that somebody is charging at you
mm-hmm.
For like 3 seconds, you'd be like, but he just like, even though, I mean, I never thought about it.
Right.
Because it was just like, it's so effective. As a,
yeah, same.
As a jump scare.
Well, this is when everyone's brought back together, though.
Yeah.
And they all meet up, or not brought back together, but introduced to each other. And we get Ash locked in the basement with Ted Raimi.
Henrietta.
In a suit.
Someone's in my fruit cellar. Someone with a fresh soul.
You're really good at that stuff, man.
I love this movie so much. I've seen it so many times. But yeah, it's funny because, but this is the first, like, when I started prepping for doing this, I've been watching it. I've watched it with the commentary twice. I've watched it, like with full attention once. I've watched it in the background three or four times.
That's why you're the best guest on the show.
I don't, because I work from home and I don't mind. Just
you put in the work, man.
Giving it my all. But it's such a fun, but yeah, I mean, this is the first time, this round of watching it was the first time I was like, oh yeah, that is obviously Ted Raimi. I can see him under there. Uh-huh. And the Henrietta suit he wears is like this latex, like, and it's not like modern latex. It was like an older.
Super heavy.
Yeah, super heavy.
Yeah.
And he had like bean bags full of lentils in there to give it like extra weight and like extra jiggle.
Uh-huh.
And, you know, it took 6 hours, I think, to put it on. And then he couldn't, you know. So it's like if you're. I don't know. I just remember like a friend of mine worked, my friend Griffin was Arthur on The Tick, the new Tick series.
Right.
And he said that like when that Peter Serafinowicz would have, he had his Tick suit.
Uh-huh.
And even something like that, which seems like it wouldn't be a really difficult suit to wear, was hot as hell. And so it's just like they had to keep the studio really cold and, you know, in order to keep him like from passing out.
Right.
They didn't have that sort of luxury for Ted Raimi.
Yeah. I've heard legendary stories about the sweat that he created.
Yeah. It was like there's one scene at the end where it's like he's spinning around, like holding Annie, and you can see sweat pouring from his ear.
I saw that. That was sweat.
It was sweat. It looks disturbing
because
you don't know what it is. And there's also a giant rip in the ass that you can at that point. Yeah, the suit had been through so much.
Yeah.
If you look at it, you can just see like there's a big gap.
Well, it's a good place to have a rip.
Exactly.
We also get in that scene one of the great campy kind of fun shots. And again, just an example of Sam Raimi's sense of fun and play when the eyeball is popped out and travels across the room into Bobby Joe's mouth.
Mm-hmm.
This is so great.
They ripped that off from a Three Stooges show.
Oh, really?
Pretty directly. They're like,
there's a lot of Three Stooges in this.
Yeah. They're like the Three Stooges are watching an opera singer, and they decide to like flip grapes at him. So they line up grapes on their elbows and start like flipping them, and one just goes right into his mouth.
Yeah.
And so that's but yeah, it's and then they have you have the eyeball point of view.
It's so great. It travels along with the eyeball. And again, Bob, you know, the actor, what was her name who played Bobby Joe?
The actor was Cassie Wesley.
Yeah, I mean. Again, knowing what type of movie she's in, her reaction in that shot was so spot on and perfect.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, she doesn't like. Yeah, and she is also, you know, and then when Ed is a lot of the violence in this, a lot of the violence you see is just people being thrown against walls. It's like that's the only time you see actual. Physical damage happening to people is when
it's kind of true because a lot of the chainsaw stuff you see off screen or in shadow or silhouette or whatever.
Yeah. But when Ed becomes possessed.
Yeah, that's the we are all the things that were and shall be again. Such a great line. The creature work in it is really fantastic.
Yeah. It's a great, it's a really good makeup work. It's
Who did that?
That would be, what I have it written down. Greg Nicotero is one of them. I think Mark Sjostrom. I was like, what did I write there?
But they weren't like Giallo legends or anything like that?
No, I think two of them had written, two of them had worked on Dawn of the Dead.
Okay.
With George Romero and, you know, I think one of them had actually worked on Evil Dead.
Uh-huh.
And they had never all worked together before. So, you know, but this was something they started production on it like, I think like 3 or 4 months beforehand, they just did all the casting. They like did the molds of everybody, and you know, they did the molds of the actors, and then they like did the casts of the faces and the masks and so on.
It really looks good.
Yeah, the evil Ed especially looks good. Like he's just got those like multiple rows of teeth and his eyes. The eyes like being whited out were a big. That was kind of a big deal. Well, not a big deal, but you know, the technology now. I believe is a lot better where they have sort of like soft shells which are like colored and you can put them in and it's
and
not
see,
that
and you can still see
Yeah. Back then, they had what they called scleral shells.
Right.
Which were not... which were basically like hard contact lenses, except for they would fit most of the eyeball.
It's like putting an eggshell over your eye.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Except for under your eyelid.
Right.
And you couldn't see. So that's why a lot of the times, you know, there's a scene, there's one scene where evil Ash has to like grab Jake.
Mm-hmm.
There's like an elbow, you know, there's a hand like guiding his hand because he can't see where it is.
Yeah,
you know?
Yeah.
You can't see anything. And so when Ted Raimi is doing all that acting with these scleral shells in, yeah. He can't see anything. So he's like it goes Ash, like as far as like great actors, like Bruce Campbell, Cassie Wexley or Wesley, Ted Raimi, in my opinion. Those are the three, like everybody else like gets a passing, gets like a B, except for, you know, I'm sorry, Richard Dommeler. You get a C. You passed. But
I love Ted Raimi, and I always get the sense that Sam loves kind of fucking with him and putting him through the ringer.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
He was his brother.
Come on. Apparently, he would just be like, come on, toughen up. You're okay.
Really?
Yeah. He was really, I mean, he also like showed up. His first on-screen appearance was in The Evil Dead where he was fake shemping.
Right. Which I always love that they use shimp in their credits. I did that on some of my short films.
Oh, really?
As tribute, yeah. Because it's just such a great word.
Yeah, shimp.
Yeah.
Yeah, there was like, it's the fake shimp is based on the Three Stooges shorts.
Uh-huh.
Shimp was the second Curly. I mean, not.
Sure.
Curly was the Curly. But,
right.
But he, shimp followed Curly, but then they wouldn't shoot every short together. They would shoot them, like, they would just shoot batches of scenes.
Mm-hmm.
And they were shooting batches of scenes for their final, and not for their final, but for a year, and the actor who played Shemp died. And so they had to – that's when they brought in the fake Shemp, the guy who had like sort of Bela Lugosi, you know, like Bela Lugosi chiropractor his way through the scenes, like just like shoot him from behind, like use old footage, et cetera, et cetera.
Yeah.
And so that's what they – that's why they have fake Shemps because they were – in the original Evil Dead, everybody was there for 6 weeks and like we can't – we only plan to be here for 6 weeks. We can't be here anymore.
Yeah.
And they left, and so they just had to bring in all these, like stand-ins.
I always just use it in my credits as a stand-in for, like, you know, bar shimp or the guy in the background that does the one thing or, you know, wood shimp.
Mm-hmm.
So I probably didn't even use it correctly, but it was my little nod to Raimi.
It's a fun – and it's shimp is a very fun word unto itself.
So Bobby Joe is taken at this point.
Yeah, she runs out.
Yeah.
Professor Raymond Nobe breaks in. There's like those great sequence of shots, which I can't remember if they did it like with a wide angle lens
mm-hmm.
and a telephoto lens. They just like those really flat. So you get those really flat shots where it's just like they shoot all over the place.
Mm-hmm.
Something he used a lot in his series, gosh, what was it called? American Gothic,
mm-hmm.
which was a fun – that was fun. And then they canceled it before it got any resolution. But, and then, like, you know, Professor Raymond Nobe comes back and says, you have the secret is in the book. You have to read the passages and get rid of the evil.
Yeah.
The severed hand grabs Bobby Joe. She mm-hmm. freaks out, runs away. Into the woods.
I'm not holding your hand.
I ain't holding your hand, baby.
Well, that introduces the whole sequence, though, where Bobby Joe is gone and Jake then is – that becomes his driving force.
Right.
To get Bobby Joe back.
Yeah. He picks up the shotgun. He's like – and tries to make them go into the woods.
Yeah.
Grabs the pages of the book. And it's funny because you watch him walk by right by a blazing fire in the fireplace, and instead he like lifts up the
lifts up the
trapdoor and throws him in there.
I didn't even think about that.
I did the last time I watched it. I did. I was like, why did he just like? But again,
sure.
Just like yeah, I don't know. I'm not going to apologize for like nitpicking anymore.
No, but we've seen it a hundred times.
Yeah.
Yeah, you can make little jokes like that.
Yeah,
it's fine.
So they go out, get Ash gets repossessed.
That's right.
And
more good creature work. Possessed Ash looks great.
Yeah. And like grabs Jake, throws him into a tree.
Mm-hmm.
She runs like Annie runs back into the cabin. She hears somebody outside, opens the door and stabs. It turns out to be Jake, who is still alive.
Stabs with a movie prop that's probably a movie prop I might want to own more than any other.
The knife that's made out of chicken bones.
Yeah, man.
It's so good.
I wonder where that ended up.
I think they might still have it. I think that according to the commentary, well, it was recorded in like 1991.
Uh-huh.
I think they still had it.
Maybe
it's like later.
So they had it 29 years ago?
Yeah. Gosh, that is just a long time ago, isn't it? Well, anyway.
Yeah. I just had my 30th class reunion. I didn't go, but it yeah.
I skipped mine as well, but not for any reason, but I was just like, I just didn't have the time. And yeah. I was just like, here's to old guys. All right.
But yeah, she stabs him with that great, great knife. The cellar blood scene when they pull in Jake is fantastic.
Yeah, where Henrietta grabs him by the head, pulls him to the cellar, and it's just like Annie just being bathed in showered actually. Just all this blood pouring out.
Oh, it was so great. Yeah. Just so much blood.
Yeah, and then it's like Ash comes back possessed. He gets depossessed because he sees that cheap necklace.
Yeah, yeah.
And he's like,
That's a great sequence when she tries to kill him with the axe.
Yeah. I'm all right now.
But she keeps coming back and she keeps coming back.
Right. And then at the end, she's like, okay, but for how long? Which is a very good point. And then
it sets up that last 15 minutes of the movie so well, though.
Yeah.
And that's where he does, you know, we get the great chainsaw scene when he's rigging up his system. And
groovy.
It's one thing I loved about Spider-Man 2. The one with Alfred Molina and Doc Ock was the surgery scene, which is the one time that Raimi goes full on Evil Dead in that movie.
Yeah, yeah.
Because he uses all those same shots, those quick zoom, like Dutch tilt zooms.
Yeah.
And in that one scene, he goes full Sam Raimi horror movie just for like a minute.
Mm-hmm.
When, you know, all the nurses are being thrown around the room and it has the POV shot of Doc Ock's tentacles going around and looking around.
Yeah.
It's like just full on Evil Dead, and it's just one little nod. I think
I need to watch that again. It's been
a hot
minute.
That was a good one.
Even the third one, which was like his weakest, because
yeah, it was all right.
I think I blame the studio for that because I think they were like, well, we've already had one villain, now we got to up the ante and have two villains.
Because
I think he just wanted to do a Sandman one. Like we got to introduce, I want to say Spawn, but it wasn't Spawn. It was Venom,
right?
Which to me, I was out of comic books by that time, so I was just like, I don't care about Venom. Give me some more Sandman.
Yeah, those first two were good though, and especially the second one, I thought is still one of the great Spider-Man movies.
Right, with a cameo by Bruce Campbell as the theater usher.
That's right.
And like being it, like you can't come in.
I forgot about that actually. So now he's rigged up with the chainsaw, and he's fully become Ash the superhero that we will come to know from Army of Darkness in the TV show.
Yeah.
When he's got all the bravado and he's not just being thrown around, he's in charge.
Yeah. And she starts reading the passages to summon the evil. But there's also a funny thing. It's like the evil manifests itself and he's like, don't look. And it's like his hair turns white.
Uh-huh.
And it's this giant, what they call the rotten apple head.
Right.
Which you don't see as much because apparently it just didn't look as good as they thought it would. So you just get to see a little bit of it. His hair turns white. And then she's like, how do we stop this thing? She's like, I only recited the first passage, the one that summons the mess, makes him evil manifest itself.
Right.
Instead of like reading the second passage.
Yeah. It's like, that's how this works.
And then she ends up getting stabbed by the hand with the chicken bone knife.
Yeah,
But she does manage to squeak out the last bit of the recitation to dispel the evil. The rift opens, sucking it in, and then it keeps on sucking. And Bruce Campbell gets sucked into the past, and cue the knights, which were apparently
such a great ending.
Yeah,
and apparently I read that Campbell had wanted to do. What essentially was Army of Darkness in the second one. He wanted him to get sucked back into through a time portal to medieval times.
Yeah.
But I think the way it worked out was great. You know, the perfect way to end this movie, because you so don't see it coming at the time, like upon first viewing.
Right. Even
it's
though
out of nowhere.
Yeah. Even though they show the picture of the guy with the chainsaw on his arm in the Book of the Dead.
True.
But you don't make the connection.
Yeah, not at all.
Yeah.
He wakes up and sees those knights around him, Ted Raimi, of course.
And Rob Tappert, who's one of the producers.
Oh, really? Yeah. Was that who that was?
Yeah.
Okay.
It's funny because you can see Ted Raimi kind of like, he sort of like has his arms bowed out, like sort of waddling. I don't know if he chose to do that because he knew it would distinguish himself or if those suits right. of armor. And the rest of the knights were played by a National Guard.
Oh, really?
Yeah. Do I call them a troop? It sounds like Boy Scouts if I say that.
Battalion?
National Guard.
Reservists?
Yeah, reservists. Sure.
Okay, sure. Why not?
and then it's like...
Such a great ending.
Yeah.
The big winged beast comes out. And he takes care of it and then is the god. He's,
yeah.
He's the king.
Hail to he who has come to save us from the demons from the sky. Hail! No, no! And it is actually, it's good because it's funny, but it's also just like really unsettling because
yeah.
he's like, he just clearly does not want to be that guy. He
no.
just like, he wants to go home to S-Mart and work a...
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah.
He owns it in three eventually.
Yeah.
But he never is the willing hero.
Yeah.
Seems like he's always just sort of roped into it.
Right. I mean, I also have to consider that he didn't get a whole lot of sleep for the last 48 hours preceding this.
Right. That's
well, he
true.
Didn't. He collapsed in a, he slept in a puddle for 8 hours. That couldn't have been very restful, though.
Yeah. I didn't even consider that, but you're totally right. did we do it? Do you got anything else?
I just want to say that I don't know how Ebert reviewed this, but I know he really liked The Evil Dead, the first Evil Dead. He was a big fan. I remember watching, I think that was another early horror movie memory I have, which was watching him reviewing Evil Dead. It must have been 1981. It was on like when it was on PBS and not syndicated, and just seeing the scene where the light bulb, he's in the basement and the light bulb fills up with blood. And I was just like, oh, that
yeah.
looks cool. But I assume he...
So you saw that on At the Movies?
Yes.
With Ebert and Roper?
Oh, no, with Siskel and Ebert.
Or Siskel and Ebert,
yeah.
I mean? Yeah.
Yeah, it was at the movie. Was it At the Movies or like... There was like the PBS version, then there was like the syndicated version.
Yeah, I can't remember which the PBS was.
Yeah.
I used to love that show.
It was so good. It was so fun to watch.
And yeah.
There's even like, if you go and look at clips, you can find clips where they're just arguing.
Oh, it's
like,
great.
And they just are really genuinely mad at each other.
Yeah.
About.
I don't think I even ever knew when that came on.
Mm-hmm.
It wasn't like appointment viewing. I just found myself catching it.
Right.
For some reason. Maybe it's because there were only, there were only three channels or whatever. But that's sort of true. You
yeah.
know, there wasn't as much around. So you would happen upon stuff
right.
with it's, regularity by accident.
PBS is kind of like, that's the way it is with PBS shows. It's like everything is like the Antiques Roadshow. You're like flipping channels. Oh, it's Antiques Roadshow.
Right.
All right.
It's like,
I'll watch this.
How many hours a day do they actually show this? It was good stuff, though, man. I love that show.
Yeah.
And that introduced me to, I was the little kid that watched Entertainment Tonight every mm-hmm. night and subscribed to Premiere Magazine. And I was way into it from an early age. It's funny to think about like a 10-year-old sitting around and watching Siskel and Ebert.
Yeah. But it is, it's true. Like you get to a point where you're, you just are. I mean, in a lot of cases, this is the only exposure I would have to many of these movies.
Yeah, me too.
You know, I didn't see – like I also remember similarly watching listening to NPR.
Uh-huh.
And I did not just grow up as an NPR PBS household, by the way. I just want to make that absolutely clear. But, when I was 14 years old, I'd wake up. The radio was set to NPR and I'd – listen to Morning Edition, and they interviewed Jim Jarmusch for Strangers in Paradise.
Interesting.
And I was like, this movie sounds crazy.
Yeah.
But weird. I mean, not crazy, but, interesting.
Yeah, different.
Yeah. So, that's a lot of the, that was how I was introduced. I mean, this is clearly before you could send around videos with ease and, like, send people links and be like,
Yeah.
There was so much word of mouth.
Well, before you could go to iTunes movie trailers and just watch all the trailers.
Mm-hmm.
Like, I loved movie trailers. I still do. But that was – I watched Siskel and Ebert largely to see what was coming.
Right. And what was worth watching and what
uh-huh.
was worth checking out.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Good stuff.
Yeah. And it's, like, it's interesting because Ebert had a – he got it. He always seemed to get it with movies like that.
Did you see the documentary?
I didn't.
The Ebert's?
I need to watch it.
Really great.
Do you know, is it streaming anywhere?
I think it still is.
Okay.
Life Itself, really, really good. Very heartwarming.
Okay. I will I will seek it out.
Yeah, you should check it out.
Yeah.
You'd appreciate it.
Excellent.
You got anything else?
I think that's about it. Do I have any other little tidbits? I think that's all I have tidbit-wise.
All right.
Yeah, just like if you haven't – I mean if you've listened this long, I assume you've already seen it.
Probably.
But go watch it again. Yeah. Man, it's worth a repeated viewing.
Watch it every October.
Yeah, watch it every October. Or, you know –
It holds up.
Yeah. Get the Blu-ray and watch – or the DVD and get the newer Blu-rays actually. I think Anchor Bay – like I said, these movies kept Anchor Bay for afloat for a long time. They shouldn't have. Anchor Bay was kind of a their transfers were always pretty bad. They did one that was like I got a two-disc set of The Evil Dead. And it was like Letterboxd edition and regular edition or the full screen edition. I was like, oh, I'll watch the Letterboxd edition. And I was watching it and there's a scene where Bruce Campbell is walking around in the basement and he is in a pool of blood and there's like a Band-Aid box floating in this pool of blood. But in the Letterboxd edition, it's cut off because it was shot in 16 millimeter.
Right.
It was never meant to be Letterboxd. It was just like a bad way of saying – it was just like a way to sort of get money out of unwary consumers like myself.
Like another edition.
Yeah.
That leaves stuff out.
Yeah.
All right, Joe. Thanks for being here, buddy.
Thank you, Chuck.
Look forward to the next one.
I am too. All right.
Movie Crush is produced, edited, and engineered by Ramsey Yunt. Here in our home studio at Pont City Market, Atlanta, Georgia, for iHeartRadio.
For more podcasts from iHeartRadio, visit the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you listen to your favorite shows.